Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Good afternoon, everyone. Okay, today we'll continue with our study of the Sutta Nipata. And now we come to Sutta number 4, I believe. This is called the Kasi Bharadwaja Sutta, the Farmer Bharadwaja. Okay, this sutta has a somewhat different character from the ones that we've studied so far, because the earlier suttas have been just poems without an explicit speaker. Actually, the Mangala Sutta, we do see the Buddha speaking, but it's entirely in the form of a poem. There's no real dramatic content. But this sutta has a story behind it, in which the Buddha has an encounter with a Brahmin. There's a kind of challenge, or rather sometimes a fierce challenge from the Brahmin, and that leads to an exchange in verse between the Brahmin and the Buddha. And this sutta also shows certain features of the Buddha's teaching technique, the way he is able to adjust his teaching and express his teaching in the way that it is exactly fitting the situation in which he finds himself, and in a way which is exactly corresponding to the understanding, the needs, the capacity of the person to be instructed. Before I explain the sutta itself, I should explain a little bit about the background to this sutta and to many other suttas. This background concerns the Buddha's daily routine. Every day, in the very early hours of the morning, after he's taken a little rest, when the Buddha rises, he sits in meditation, and he enters into a state called the fruition attainment of arhatship. This is the state in which he experiences the bliss of Nibbana. Then after emerging from that state, he enters into a state called the meditative attainment of great compassion, the Maha Karuna Samapatti. In this state, he permeates or pervades the whole world with great compassion. Then when the Buddha emerges from this state, then he uses his special faculties of knowledge to examine the minds of sentient beings, particularly those in the area where he's living, to find out if there are any people in that area whose minds have ripened to the point where they are ready to reach some level of realization, or in which they can be benefited in some way from the teaching. Okay, so on this particular day, the Buddha, when he emerged from the meditation on great compassion, he used his faculty of knowledge to survey the people in the area where he was living, and he saw that this Brahmin named Kasi Bharadwaja had the capacity for understanding the teaching, even for giving up his status as a Brahmin, taking refuge in the Triple Gem, and then going forth into homelessness as a monk, and eventually achieving arhantship. But this Brahmin's mind was still covered over by several layers of delusion, wrong views, pride, conceit. And so the Buddha had to find the appropriate techniques, the appropriate way to deal with that Brahmin in order to break through those delusions, to break up that conceit and wrong view. And so the way the Buddha often approaches people who are to be trained is by going on alms round. This is an ancient custom in India going back long before the time of the Buddha. It was the particular structure in Indian society which enabled India to produce a class of religious and spiritual seekers who could devote themselves full time to the quest for higher wisdom, the quest for enlightenment, the quest for liberation. And so those who wanted to embark upon this quest would go forth, chu-cha, they would leave home, giving up the household life, taking up the life of an ascetic, a wanderer, a monk. They do not do any type of remunerative work, do not plow the fields, do not work in government service, do not do any kind of manual work in the service of others for their own behalf that will bring in accumulations of money. But they live penniless, often without a fixed abode, wandering from place to place, depending upon the faith and devotion of people living the household life who respect, esteem, and revere those devoted to this quest for higher wisdom, for liberation. It doesn't mean that people will support only those wanderers or ascetics of a particular religious belief that they share, but the general population would respect anyone who has embarked upon this quest, and as they wander from home to home with their bowl, seeking just enough food to sustain them for one day, people would give according to their faith, sometimes generously, sometimes just a little, in the belief that by doing so, they are doing something worthy, helping some of these ascetics advance themselves in the quest for truth. Also, they do so in the belief that by giving and supporting the wandering ascetics, they are acquiring punya, fu bao. This is spiritual merit, which will eventually ripen and bring benefits to themselves in future lives. They believe that this merit will lead to higher rebirth, to prosperity, wealth in future lives, and most important, that this merit will become a supporting condition for their own future attainment of liberation. It is the merit from supporting those in quest of liberation that comes back to oneself and becomes the supporting condition for one's own effort to attain liberation. And so when the Buddha and other wanderers and Buddhist monks right up to the present, when they go on alms round, if we look at it from the modern American or modern materialistic point of view, we think these are beggars, these are just mendicants, these are requesting favors and help from other people who have the wealth, the resources to give to them. But if we look at the situation from a spiritual point of view, the one who is performing the higher act of giving is the Buddha, the wandering ascetic, the monk who goes on alms round and opens his bowl to the offerings of others. Because it is by opening that bowl to the offerings of others that an enlightened one, or one in quest of enlightenment, enables others to, in a sense, participate in his own enlightenment, to share in his own enlightenment, to acquire the supporting conditions, the connections that will contribute to their own attainment of liberation, nibbana, nirvana. So we can say that it is that open alms bowl held out before the householders, before those who have the means to make material offerings, that open alms bowl that opens the doors to the deathless, to those who have the faith, devotion, the willingness to give to them. Okay, so this is the background now to this story, to this sutta. And so when the sutta opens, the Buddha is living in or near a Brahmin village called Eganala, which is situated in the district of Dakinagiri in the country, it's Dakinagiri in the country of Magadha. This is close to where Rajgir is situated in modern India. Okay, and at this time, it was the sowing season. I'm now reading from the sutta, from the text on page 8. It was the sowing season, and 500 plows owned by the Brahmin Kasi Dwara Bharadvaja were set to work. Now, it might seem a little strange that a Brahmin is involved with plowing. We think the Brahmins are the religious caste in ancient India, that they should be involved in performing rituals and ceremonies. But what had happened by the Buddha's time, you see, because the Brahmins traditionally were performing these sacred rites and rituals that had come down from the Vedas, that the kings and princes would offer them land in exchange for their services. And so the Brahmins became a kind of landed aristocracy, owning villages, large tracts of land, and then they would use this land for cultivation, for growing crops, which they would then sell and market, and then this would help increase their wealth. Okay, so now, one morning, the Buddha puts on his robe, takes his alms bowl, his extra robe, and goes to that place where Kasi Bharadvaja's work was in progress. And according to the commentary, this was not just an ordinary work day, but this was the first day of the sowing season. And so in India at that time, and I think it's done even right down to the present, the first day of the sowing season is a day of special ceremonies and celebrations. So that's why the Brahmin had 500 plows. 500 is maybe an exaggeration, but it just indicates a large number. 500 plows were ready. The commentary gives elaborate description. The cattle were all decorated with ornaments, golden decorations on their horns. The people had all put on their finest clothes. The women were preparing special foods, very delicious food, what they called milk rice, piasin. And now it was lunchtime, and all of the Brahmins and other people were all sitting down at their tables. They had their plates. The food servers were going along the lines, serving everybody their foods and their food and their plates. And suddenly, from behind the hill, this calm, solemn figure appears, wearing ochre robes, walking quietly with an alms bowl in his hand. And he arrives at the place where the food was being distributed, and he stands to one side. He doesn't ask for anything that's not permitted, not the way of the Buddhas, but he just stands there silently with his alms bowl. The Brahmin looks at him, sees him standing for alms, and says to him, "O recluse, I plow and sow, and having plowed and sown, I eat. You too, recluse, should plow and sow, and having plowed and sowed, you should eat." Okay, though this criticism of the Buddha might be phrased in terms coming from an ancient agricultural society, but I would say that this kind of criticism is in no way old-fashioned or a thing of the past. But this is very common criticism of those who are leading this religious life in which they depend upon the offerings of others. Why aren't you doing anything useful? Why are you just begging for the offerings of others? Why are you just walking around with your alms bowl, expecting others to feed you, to give you everything? Why can't you be going out at 8 a.m., 9 a.m., people start work at 9 a.m. Why can't you be going out in your car at 8 a.m., going to office, going to the workplace, working, putting in a full day from 9 to 5, like everybody else? This was the criticism the communists were making of the monks in China after the communist revolution. They're just parasites exploiting the ignorant faith of others in order to live comfortable lives of self-indulgence. And even today, we hear such charges made. Okay, so this is what the Brahmin is saying to the Buddha. Why don't you go out and work for a living? If you put in a full day's work, like the rest of us are doing, sowing the field, working in an office, doing some computer programming, engineering, accounting, some other kind of useful work, then you'll be entitled to your day's meal. But not this going around with this alms bowl from house to house, expecting us to feed you. Okay, but now the Buddha uses his skillful means by making a statement that's going to stop the Brahmin in his tracks. The Buddha says, I too, Brahmin, plow and sow, and having plowed and sown, I eat. Okay, the Buddha says this, and now the Brahmin is puzzled. And so he says, you know, he's stopped in his tracks now, and he knows how these monastic people live. So he says, I don't see any yoke, I don't see any plow, I don't see any plowshare, goat or oxen of the Venerable Gotama. And yet you say, I plow and sow, and having plowed and sown, I eat. And then he addresses the same point, he makes the same point in verse. And notice that in this verse, or rather in this statement that the Brahmin makes to the Buddha, when the Buddha says that he plows and sows, now when the Brahmin speaks to the Buddha, instead of calling him rather rudely, recluse, he now calls him Bo Gotama. It's a somewhat respectful form of address. It means something like the Honorable Gotama. It's not the venerable meaning venerable monk, but it's a kind of respectful address that Brahmins use with each other. Okay, so then the Brahmin says to the Buddha, you claim to be a farmer, yet we do not see your plowing. Being questioned by us about your plowing, tell us in such a way that we can understand it, that we can know of it. And now the Buddha is going to explain how he plows and sows. And this is what we call the core or center of the sutta. And here I like to, again, to recite the verses in Pali. Sadha bijang tapo vuti panya me yuga nangalang hiri isa mano yutang sati me pala pachanam. So the first verse says, faith, I like to use the word faith rather than confidence. Faith is the seed. Tapo, austerity or self-control, is, this is the wrong rain. This should be R-A-I-N, the rain that falls down. Wisdom is my yoke and plow. Modesty, this is hiri, the sense of shame, moral shame, is my pole. Mind is the rope. Mindfulness is my plowshare and goad. Okay, we start with this line, Sadha Bijan. Faith is the seed. And this is really extremely important. And I think one has to understand, here the Buddha the way I understand these verses, the Buddha is not talking about the means of training or confidence, the means of training or practice that he used for himself, but rather the means of training or practice that he uses to guide and train other beings, other people. Of course, the Buddha had used this training for himself, but he's already completed that training himself. He doesn't have to pursue it any further. But now he is like the farmer who cultivates the crops. And the crops that he cultivates are other people, other living beings who are capable of bearing fruit, of reaching realization, attainment. And so the Buddha's first task as a spiritual teacher, just as the farmer's first task is to cast the seeds upon the soil, or the farmer needs the seeds in order to get the crops. Without seeds, the farmer will not be capable of getting any crops. And so the Buddha, his first task is to generate faith, confidence, or trust in the people to be trained, people to be guided. And the commentary gives interesting explanation, or follows through this analogy. It says that a seed does two things. The seed, first of all, it sends down roots. Then, from the seed, there arises the stalk or the shoot. And when the seed sends down the roots are able to take the nutrients out from the soil, and they send those nutrients into the stalk. The stalk metabolizes the nutrients brought up from the soil, and it uses those nutrients so that the stalk will send out the branches. The branches will bear the fruits or the crops that the farmer will then harvest in order to have his crops, his grain, which he could then use some and then sell the rest in the market. And so when one has the seed of faith, that is the beginning or starting point for all higher development. And faith begins this process of development by sending out roots. And what are these roots? The roots are sila, that is the observance of the code of moral discipline, the observance of precepts, jaya. And then when a person has faith and a moral character, proper disposition to moral virtue, an upright ethical character, the moral purity of that person's character enables that person to absorb the nutrients from the Buddha's teachings of the higher training. These are the teachings on developing samadhi, developing panya, developing concentration and wisdom. Ding and Hui, Zhou Hui. Okay, and when the person absorbs those nutrients from that Buddha's teaching, then those teachings get absorbed into that person's character, they become part of the person's practice, and the person is able to succeed in the practice of samadhi, meditation, and panya, and is then able to, in time, bring forth the, call it the flowers of enlightenment and the fruits of liberation. And so, so much depends upon having that seed of faith as the starting point. Okay, the next line says, tapo vuti. The word tapo means, or I translate it as austerity. Here, the translator uses self-control. Originally, in ancient India, it suggested self-mortification, self-affliction. The Buddha took over that word, but without the idea of self-affliction, self-mortification, but used it often to indicate energy or strong right effort. But the commentary explains here that what is meant by austerity or self-control is not energy, because energy comes later in the poem, in verse 4. Here, energy is translated as exertion. But rather, what is meant by self-control here is the restraint of the senses, control of the senses. This is because control of the senses is important in protecting one's moral discipline and enabling one's moral discipline to be able to lead on to concentration and wisdom. And so self-control, restraint of the senses, functions like rain. Just as when rain comes and goes into the ground, then that rain nurtures the seed, it nurtures the roots. And so this restraint of the senses becomes important for safeguarding one's moral discipline and enabling that moral discipline to reach a higher level of purity, whereby it can gradually give rise to concentration and to wisdom. Then the next line says, Panya, prajna, chowei, is my yoke and plow. The commentary gives a very detailed explanation of how each of these characteristics, each of these Buddhist practices, fills the analogy with parts of a plow. But I have to say, since I don't have an experience in using a plow, I found that explanation a little bit difficult to follow, and I think for us to be able to discuss it, I would need a diagram showing a plow, and then we would have to study how a plow is constructed. So let's, instead of focusing upon the analogy, just take the qualities themselves. Okay, here wisdom is a yoke, because the yoke joins the two draft animals, like the two oxen. The draft animals will be identified with effort or energy. And so wisdom is what is able to keep one's energy under control and direct it towards the right purpose. And wisdom, like the plow, is what does the cutting of the soil and breaking up the roots. And so wisdom here is what does the cutting up of wrong notions, wrong deluded notions. And wisdom is what cuts up all of the roots of the defilements. And since wisdom is mentioned quite early in the poem, in the analogy. I would understand wisdom here not necessarily in the sense of the higher wisdom, you know, the wisdom that comes through the development of insight, but I would take wisdom to be the kind of preliminary wisdom of right view, of right understanding, that guides one's practice along the path. And since this is the Buddha using his own qualities to guide and teach living beings, we might also understand this to mean the Buddha using his own wisdom as a way to understand other people and to train people in the right way, in the way that's suitable for them. Okay, then the next quality is modesty. Modesty is is a translation of the word hiri, which I usually translate as a sense of shame. So it doesn't mean being bashful or ashamed, the way we usually use that word, but it means a sense of conscience or self-respect that protects one from engaging in immoral actions or unwholesome actions. Then mind is the rope. And according to the commentary, what is meant by mind here, this is a kind of substitute term for samadhi or concentration. Since concentration, like the rope is used to hold the animals in place, to guide the animals. And so one uses concentration to bind the mind onto the object of meditation and prevent the mind from slipping away, roaming away. Then mindfulness is my plowshare and goad. Mindfulness means keeping the mind aware of what is going on within one's own mind, and keeping everything within the mind in a state of balance. And so we could say that the Buddha is always mindful whenever he is teaching and guiding others, and he also instructs others to use mindfulness as a way of guiding and controlling their own conduct. Through mindfulness, one knows what is going on in one's mind, and that enables one to guide one's conduct, to behave in the proper way, the right way. Then we come to the next verse. Kaya guto vachi guto ahare udare yato sachang karomi nidanam surachang me pumochanam. My bodily action is well guarded, speech is well guarded, moderate in food, I make truth the destroyer of weeds, and calm, or I would prefer gentleness, is my release. Okay, when one has mindfulness as plowshare and goad, then bodily and verbal action will be well guarded. This is indicating here quite explicitly right action and right speech. Then moderation in food, this shows the object the aspect of virtue, of moral discipline, as making proper use of the requisites of life. Because people give things to a monastic person out of faith. And so one has to be very moderate in one's use of these things, not to make extravagant use of them, but to take just the moderate amount of food that one needs to sustain oneself and keep oneself in good health. And then the Buddha uses truth as the destroyer of weeds. You could say he uses truthful speech to destroy the weeds of all the wrong doctrines, wrong views that others are proclaiming. And then he uses the truth of wisdom, the truth that's grasped and understood through knowledge, to destroy all the delusions that come, all of the delusions that come from wrong views. And then when all of these delusions and wrong views are destroyed, then there comes this release, which is called sorachang in Pali. It means something like gentleness or tranquility. Then he comes to the next verse. Viryang me duradoraiham yoga kemadi vahanam gachati anivantam yata ganva nasochati. Exertion or energy. This is virya, virile energy, is my draft, my oxen, draft animals, which carries me towards, I like the Pali, it doesn't explicitly say Nibbana, but it says towards yoga kema, towards release from bondage, towards the security from bondage. And this means that the effort, the right effort, carries one towards the state which is the security from all of the bonds that keep one bound within this round of birth and death. That is, that liberates one from samsara. Then it goes without stopping or without turning back. And having gone there, one does not sorrow. That is, it takes one to the state where there's no more sorrow, no more suffering. And then the Buddha concludes his explanation to the Brahman. He says, evam esa kasi kata sa hoti amatapala etang kasing kasitvana sabaduka pamuchati. In this way, the plowing is done and it bears the deathless as its fruit. Really important word here is amatapala. It has as its fruit the deathless state. Maybe the word immortality suggests that the person becomes everlasting or immortal, but that is not nirvana. Sorry. But it's nirvana is the deathless state, since it's the state beyond birth and death. And then when one does this type of plowing, then one is freed from all suffering, from all dukkha. Now this Brahman, we have to understand, was not an ordinary person with just shallow roots, but this Brahman must have had very strong and good roots from earlier lives, which was why the Buddha went to him in the first place. But those good roots had been covered up by this layer of conditioning from this life. Since he was born in a Brahmin family, always told the Brahmins are the best caste, that these wandering ascetics are useless parasites, just that they exploit people. And so he developed this layer of wrong views. But the Buddha knew that when he explained the Dharma to him in this way, that he would be able to reach through and to break up that layer of wrong views and awaken his good tendencies. And so when the Buddha spoke these verses, the Brahmin's wholesome roots started to awaken. And the Brahmin started to develop faith. And especially when the Buddha spoke about bearing the fruit of immortality, bearing the fruit of the deathless, the Brahmin was suddenly stirred and very excited. And so he filled a large golden bowl with milk rice and offered it to the Buddha, asking the Buddha to take the milk rice, because he spoke about plowing in such a way that he bore the fruit of immortality. But now the Buddha speaks some other verses by which he is going to refuse that offering. This is what the Buddha says. Again, I like the Pali. Gata bhigitam meya bhojaneyam sampasatang brahmana nesadammo gata bhigitam panudanti buddha Dhamme sati brahmana vutaresa. He says, what is obtained by chanting hymns is not to be eaten by me. This Brahman is not the practice of those who see rightly. The Buddhas refuse what is obtained by chanting hymns. This is their practice. This is the principle they observe. Then the Brahmin then becomes very disappointed and sad. He thinks, how can I get merits now? Suddenly the Buddha comes to me. I have this great opportunity, this unique opportunity, and I blew it by first refusing to give the Buddha an offering. And so now the Buddha doesn't want to leave the Brahmin disappointed, and so when the Buddha knows the Brahmin has become downcast, the Buddha is going to give him another opportunity. The Buddha says, you should serve other food and drink to an accomplished great sage, one who has destroyed all the asavas, all of the mental impurities, and who is free from all wrongdoing, all remorse. This is the field for him who seeks merit. Okay, so now the Buddha has told the Brahmin that he can give, still make an offering just by taking other food and offering it to him. But the Buddha won't accept the food that was originally there to be offered, because the Buddha doesn't want to accept food that could have been offered in the first place, but that was originally held back, because, and then would only be given because the Buddha had recited some verses. So then the Brahmin asks, to whom should I give this milk rice, the milk rice that he originally had out on the table? Then the Buddha says, and this will seem somewhat strange to us, the Buddha says, in this world, together with its gods, with Mara, Brahma, and among all this human population, with its Brahmins and human beings, I do not see anyone except a Tathagata, that is, except the Buddha himself, or a disciple of the Tathagata. And according to the commentary, this means by disciple of a Tathagata, a disciple of the Buddha who has achieved arahatship together with the psychic powers and all the attainments in samadhi, who could properly digest this milk rice. It's a little puzzling why this seems like the same milk rice that everybody else is eating. Why now could nobody else eat it and digest it? The commentary says that from the moment that rice had been put out to be offered to the Buddha, it had been infused with very powerful nutritive essence by the deities. And so nobody else could digest it. I'm not sure that I would accept that explanation. What seems to me to be the case is that because that food could have been taken by the Buddha, it was in a position to have been offered to the holiest, most spiritually enlightened, most perfect being in the world. Somehow, now it's become infused with this kind of spiritual essence, too powerful for anybody else to eat except the Buddha himself or one of his disciples who has reached very high level of attainment. And so then, when the Buddha says this, the Brahmin asks, what should I do then with this milk rice? And the Buddha says, you had better cast this milk rice either in a place where there is no grass or float it in water where there are no living creatures. And so then the Brahmin takes the milk rice and he puts it in water. And when the milk rice enters the water, it makes a hissing sound as though it were a red-hot iron plowshare. But if you take a red-hot piece of metal, put it in water, the water will start hissing and bubbling in the same way that water started to hiss and to give off steam and smoke on all sides. And then the Brahmin became very excited. He came to the Buddha, fell down at the Buddha's feet, and he declared himself a follower of the Buddha. He said, it is amazing, Master Gotama. It is wonderful, Master Gotama. Just as if one might turn upright what had been overturned, reveal what had been hidden, point out the way to one who has gone astray, or hold out a lamp in the dark so that those who have eyes can see objects, so likewise has the truth, or the Dhamma, been explained by Master Gotama in various ways. Therefore, I go for refuge to Master Gotama, to his Dhamma, and to his Sangha. And now this is somewhat surprising. The Brahmin says, I wish to enter the homeless life, that is, to become a monk and to receive the higher ordination under Master Gotama. These lines, this is actually a stock passage which comes many times in the suttas, by which somebody first declares himself or herself a Buddhist follower by taking the three refuges and then by asking for the two stages of ordination. First, going forth by becoming a novice monk, then by asking for the higher ordination to become a bhikkhu, a highly ordained monk. Probably, my guess is that the Brahmin would not have known of these two stages of ordination, but the compilers of the discourses use this fixed wording, which they attach whenever somebody wants to become a monk. So the Brahmin would have learned about the different stages of ordination, I think, only later. In any case, when the Brahmin makes this request, then he receives ordination as a novice, and then receives the higher ordination under the Buddha. Then, a short time after his ordination, by leading a secluded life, practicing diligently, energetically, with a resolute will, in a short time, he understood, experienced, and attained the highest perfection of a noble life, for which the sons of good families leave the household life and take to the life of homelessness. And he realized that rebirth had been ended, the noble or holy life has been led, what had to be done has been done, and there was nothing else to be done in this earthly existence. And so the Brahmin, former Brahmin, Kasidvaratvaja, became one of the Arahants. And that is the end of the sutta. Okay, I thank you all for your attention. Then if anybody has any questions arising out of the sutta, please feel welcome to ask.
I don't know how to express this question, but I'll try. Now, at the time when Lord Buddha was alive, and he could see from his divine sight that somebody is in need of that help, such as this Kasidvaratvaja, and he traveled to his place. So he benefited him by his dhamma directly from his own words.
Yeah.
In today's time, if there is a Kasidvaratvaja somewhere, how is that Kasidvaratvaja going to get his roots purified?
I think the way it happens is that if somebody has good roots from a previous lives, and those roots are maturing, or they have the tendency, opportunity to mature, somehow or another, that person, no matter where they are born, wherever they are living, they will come into contact with the Dhamma. They'll come into a contact with the teacher.
Today in India, they have the farmers are having the internet and all these things.
Yeah.
So probably there's no going to website.
Yeah.
So the speaker through the microphone, we can't hear you in the back.
Okay, that's a good point. Some others have asked me to use a microphone too. Okay, the question basically is, in the Buddha's time, there was the Buddha who would be able to know who are the people that have good roots from previous lives. And so when the Buddha would know this, the Buddha would be able to go to them and teach them the Dhamma in such a way that he would be able to connect with them and to awaken their good roots and then lead them onto the path of the Dhamma. So then Mr. Sogal or Segal asked, how is that to happen today when we don't have the Buddha in our midst? Then Venerable Subhuti said, in India, even farmers have computers now by which they can log on to the internet. Yeah, there's a website called BuddhaNet. It doesn't always happen that a teacher will sort of look into your mind and find out that this is the person with good roots and then will go to you. But just if you have good roots from previous lives, somehow a connection will take place. It might be you just go to a bookstore and maybe you just see on a bookcase some books on Buddhism and suddenly you don't know anything about Buddhism, but something attracts you to a book on Buddhism. Or maybe you're driving down a street and there's a Buddhist center on the street, a Buddhist temple, and suddenly you think, what is that? And then out of curiosity, you go into the Buddhist temple, and then that begins one's life as a Buddha. Sharon.
Okay. The first one, you say the face is the seat, right?
Yeah.
And the second one is self-modification.
Self-control.
Oh, self-control. Yeah. It's not a self-modification.
No. In India, the word tapas, or tapo, before the time of the Buddha, or even continuing on, had been interpreted or understood to mean self-mortification. The Buddha used the word tapas, or tapo, but he didn't interpret it or explain it to mean self-mortification, but he explained it to mean striving with energy, effort. And also to mean here self-control, according to the commentary, in the sense of restraint of the senses. And yes. Okay, go on.
And the third one is panja, is wisdom.
Wisdom.
And the fourth one is, you're talking about mindfulness?
The fourth one in the verse, it's translated as modesty.
Modesty.
The Pali is Hiri, which I also translate as a sense of shame.
Sense of shame.
A sense of moral shame, yeah.
Okay. And that's four, right?
Yeah.
And the last one is energy.
So energy comes actually later in verse 4. Here it's called exertion.
Exertion. So totally is how many total?
I actually didn't count all the factors.
Is it five?
No, there are more. Well, we have to go through the verse and count all the factors individually. I didn't enumerate them all.
Okay.
But there are 1, 2, 3 verses. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. It seems that there are 11 character qualities altogether.
Okay. In the very beginning, you explained the Buddha's daily life routine, and you mentioned that before the Buddha goes on for an armstrong, he will enter into a meditation first, the fruition of arahantship, and then
Maha compassionate, yeah. So that he will investigate who will be ready for his teaching.
Right.
I would like to know, is this based on the commentary of Pali?
Yes. Okay, the question is this account of the Buddha's schedule whereby he goes into the, first goes into this meditation on the fruit of arhatship, then goes into the meditation on great compassion, then observes the mental tendencies of living beings. Does this come from the commentary? Yeah, it comes from the commentary. It's mentioned in the commentaries to, I think, the several of the Nikayas.
In the Sutta tradition, they do not have this kind of explanation.
One doesn't have it in the Suttas, no. Take the microphone.
I was just curious, like, what does it imply when he rejected the second time? He offered the milk rice. Does it imply that he will not accept the food on as a bride or as a... I don't understand why he rejected it the second time.
Okay, the question is, why the Buddha rejected the food the second time. It was actually only one time that the Buddha rejected it, not two times. The first time when the Buddha appeared on the scene, the Brahmin didn't want to offer him the food. Then they had this exchange, because the Brahmin didn't want to offer him the food because he thought that the Buddha didn't deserve it since he was not doing any useful work. Then the Buddha gave this explanation of how he also plows and sows. Then at the end of this, the Buddha's explanation in verse, the Brahmin's opinion about the Buddha changed and he wanted to offer him the milk rice. But the Buddha refused to accept it. And he says that the explanation that he gives is that he won't accept food that's obtained by reciting verses. I think the idea is that since he had to convince the Brahmin by reciting these verses in order to change the Brahmin's mind, he won't accept that particular plate of food that was available for him to take, or food from that particular pot. Because it seems like...
trade-off.
Excuse me?
Trade-off.
I didn't catch the word.
A trade-off.
Maybe a little bit like a trade-off. Like he's used his skill in composing verses to gain the food, the offering of food. Almost like it's a reward for his skill in verses, in verse composition. But he did give the Brahmin an opportunity to offer, to make an offering. He said, serve it other food and drink, but not that which was already out. Another question? Any other questions? That particular point? Yeah, it's a little obscure. I can't really give a full explanation of it either myself. But that's the way I understand it. All I could do is just take another look at the original verse. Katabi gitang meya bhojaniyang. That is not to be eaten by me, which has been sort of sung over by verses. This is not the practice of those who see rightly, of those who rightly understand. The Buddhas reject Gatabhigita. They reject food that has been sung over with verses. This is a principle that's observed by them. There could be some explanation for it rooted in the Indian customs of that period, perhaps concerning Brahminic practices that are not fully clear to us. That's all I can say. Perhaps, this is what occurs to me, that Brahmins would go to, they would be invited by kings to come to the palace, then they would recite verses, maybe from the Vedas, hymns from the Vedas, then the kings would give them offerings of food in return for reciting the verses. And maybe this situation seemed too much like that to the Buddha, like he is functioning almost like a Brahmin, chanting verses and then receiving the food as an offering in exchange. Perhaps any further questions? Okay.
Okay, I have a question.
Okay.
So this verse is talking about not the Buddha's own practice of sowing the seed of faith in others, but sowing the seed of faith in oneself. Is that right?
The way I understand, the Buddha is speaking about himself as sowing the seed of faith in others. Like, he doesn't have to sow the seed of faith in himself anymore, since he's already accomplished all of the work that has to be done through faith. But now his task as a farmer, as a plowman, is to go around and sow the seed of faith in others, that is, to arouse in others faith in himself as the Buddha. Sometimes by discussion, sometimes by sermons, sometimes by just by the display of his bearing, sometimes by the display of supernormal powers.
It's just kind of strange to me that, you know, say I'm a practitioner or someone else is a practitioner who take up faith in the Buddha and then practices diligently himself or herself and cut off the roots of defilements and all that. And that seems to me it's very good for that person reaching liberation. But doesn't seem so wonderful for others, so that we should make offerings to that practitioner. It just, in the modern sense, it's kind of difficult for me to accept that concept. If you're saying that it's because that person sowed a seed in others, so that others will be able to achieve happiness, tranquility, that makes me feel like that person is more deserving of my offering.
Let's say the first case again.
If it's in the case of Buddha,
yeah.
I don't think there's any argument.
Yeah.
The Buddha is the greatest teacher in the world.
Yeah.
There's no argument there. But when we use that case in other ascetics, in other practitioners, when other practitioners practice diligently, and you want to convince, let's say, a new Buddhist or someone who's not Buddhist that person is so much deserving of our offering, I find it difficult to persuade others. Because I say, okay, you know, it's very nice that person reaches liberation. Why should I make offerings to that person? Nothing that I won't. I'm just saying, I just feel that, in a modern sense, a very hard sell.
Okay. Okay, her question or point is that she says it's difficult to see why to convince others to make offerings to somebody who is working hard for their own liberation, who is not out, like the Buddha, trying to liberate others. Okay, we say that this is a person who is working to put the Buddha's teaching into practice and to really reap the fruits of the Buddha's teaching. And in order to be able to really reap the fruits of the Buddha's teaching, that person needs certain conditions in which to practice earnestly. If there's no, say, lay community supporting a community of contemplative monastics who are devoting themselves to, say, intensive training and meditation, then there's no opportunity for those monastics to diligently devote themselves wholeheartedly to that training and meditation. And without that opportunity to commit oneself, devote oneself wholeheartedly to the training and meditation, it's very difficult to achieve realization of the fruits. One has to proceed in a much more slower, much more gradual way. And so when one supports those who are practicing very earnestly, very diligently, then one is really helping them to gain realization of the teaching. And then by helping them to gain realization of the teaching, one is also helping to create more people who will be capable of teaching and guiding others from their own experience, not just by depending upon books to teach and guide others. But when we'll have people who have practical experience and then who can give guidance based on their own practical experience, their own realization. And even if the person doesn't have that capacity to become a teacher or a guide themselves, but still, even by supporting them for their own liberation, one is still performing a very noble and valuable service. Okay, Debbie, get the microphone first.
Can I have one more question?
Yeah.
About the Buddha refused the offering from the Brahmin, I try to make an analogy to nowadays Chinese traditional practice. For example, people who wish to do chanting, asking for blessings from the Buddha, or sometimes when there are people pass away, we do the kind of ceremony. Chanting or whatever to try to help the give the merit to the dead person so that they can go to the better one or that kind of thing. And then the lay people who offer to the monastic who perform that kind of ceremony. And here we don't do that kind of activity here.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking that Buddha does not accept that kind of offering because he does not want to do the things that the people fear that I need to pay you for your service.
It could be something like that, like, yeah, actually that's a very good analogy. Almost like the food, offering of food is almost like a payment for a service.
So, but we make offerings to Dharma teachers. After a great lecture, people happily make offerings to the Dharma teachers.
Yeah.
And that's considered a very, I would think, a very respectful thing to do. And now you're telling me that that's a trade-off, like I'm
saying,
making offerings for your knowledge?
Anyway, it seems that this, the Buddha's refusal, it's maybe the safest way for me to handle it, say it's rooted in particular background in ancient Indian Brahminic tradition that we have difficulty understanding today. Our time has come to stop. Okay, we will end by sharing the merit with the Devas, the Buddhas, the Nagas, and other beings. Akasata Chabumata Devanaga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam akasata chabumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumotiva chirang rakantu desanam akasata chabumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumotiva chirang rakantu mantaram etavata ca ammehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata ca ammehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata ca ammehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Yeah, the next sutta that we take from the Sutta Nipata will be number 6. That's the Parabhava Sutta. And then after that, number 7, the Vatsala Sutta.